So I'm here with Megan Sullivan of Book Dwarf, who was the nominator of the LBC finalist, Jamestown. Megan, how are you doing, and why did you choose this book?
Good. I'm doing very well, thank you. I think this is one of the best books I've read this year, and I think it's because, I think Sharp really has a very good handle on language, and he writes it in such a way that I couldn't put it down. So I decided when I had to nominate something that is like I immediately knew this is the book that I was going to nominate.
Okay.
No question.
Was it the vernacular of this book that attracted you, or more of the
allegory? Yeah, definitely.
Allegory?
I love the play on language. I love that Pocahontas talks like a valley girl. I love that a lot of the people coming from New York have this kind of antiquated speech patterns, but also it's all modern, you know?
Yeah. It's interesting because you picked this book as well as Rupert Thompson's Divided Kingdom. So part of me is thinking...
I was thinking about that earlier, actually, yeah. About my various choices. I think it's because I admire writers who take chances, because often they don't work. When you try something new, when you try something sort of experimental, it can go very wrong. But I think Sharp, as well as Thompson, it went really right for them because they're such good writers, so...
Well, I was going to ask if you were sort of naturally attracted to sort of apocalyptic books like this.
Actually, I think I am. I don't know if that says bad things about me, but I do like the sort of post-apocalyptic novel. I think it's just an interesting sort of technique to see what, everyone always wants to know what will happen when no more humanity or humanity's on the downward slope. I mean, what happens to people? What happens to the future of people?
Do you feel, though, I think this book differs in the sense that I've sort of described to people as the only post-apocalyptic book out there that actually has a sense of humor. Is that really what it boils down to? Or?
Yeah, I think one of the things I liked about it so much was that it was so funny, but it was not... I mean, yes, there's negative parts, obviously, but the negative parts aren't because of the apocalypse. It's because it's dealing with human beings, and human beings are, can be very negative. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense. I'm wondering if you feel that apocalyptic scenarios are the best way to, I guess, really get at this kind of underpinning of human behavior.
Yeah, actually, you know what? You just said exactly what I feel. Thank you.
Okay. Megan, thanks very much for chit-chatting and for telling about
some. Oh, thank you for reading it and liking the book. So.
All right.
Don't like living in a dirty town, don't like living in a dirty town. I don't like living in a dirty town, cause a dirty town gets me down.
Okay, so I am here with Matthew Sharp, author of the LBC finalist, Jamestown. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm all right.
First off, actually, I wanted to actually ask you, of all the apocalyptic novels that have graced the shelves over the past years, yours is perhaps the only one with a sense of humor, and I'm wondering if you have a theory about this. Are Jim Crace and Cormac McCarthy Johnny Come Latelys to the apocalyptic novel genre, or did you have a fairly good idea of what the apocalyptic novel was about when you actually initiated this?
Can I get a bagel, toasted bagel with cream cheese, please? No, just water is good. Thanks.
I'm fine, thanks.
I'm sorry, I completely lost the question.
Okay. Of all the apocalyptic novels I happen to read over the last year, yours is perhaps the only one which actually has a sense of humor to it. I'm wondering if you had any particular thoughts on this. Did you have a knowledge of the apocalyptic novel coming into writing Jamestown? Or do you feel that Jim Crace and Cormac McCarthy are Johnny Come Latelys to the genre or whatnot?
It's been pointed out to me quite a number of times that mine is one of a spate of post-apocalyptic novels to hit the stands in 2006, 2007, and the only one I have read is The Road, and I actually just read it a couple of weeks ago. There is really one very funny bit. There are a couple of funny bits in it. I actually do think that Cormac McCarthy has a wonderful, understated sense of humor, but it's not a laugh riot. I think... I suppose I have a number of... predecessors or influences when I don't know if they're necessarily apocalyptic novelists, but they are certainly war novelists who I think are very funny, and Vonnegut and Joseph Heller are two obvious ones. Haruki Murakami, I think, has a great sense of humor. Donald Barthelme, I don't even know that I would consider him a war novelist, but he... I've been influenced by the way that he writes about history. Even in short stories like Cortez and Montezuma, And then Susan Laurie Parks, I think, also is somebody who's hilariously funny and kind of scathing about history. So I suppose these are my models more than apocalyptic novels per se. I guess Philip K. Dick has written a number of futuristic novels. Not a hilariously funny guy. I guess I'm not a terribly well-read person in the areas of science fiction or even historical fiction, so I guess I'm actually deeply underqualified to be entering the genre, but I try to make up for it by being somewhat of a clown.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what caused you to sort of, I guess, use this post-apocalyptic setting as the sort of allegorical representation of Jamestown? And also, the other question about these antecedents you were mentioning in terms of contemporary literature is, of course, John Barth's The Sotweed Factor, which is likewise this great satirical novel about Jamestown as well, to some degree.
I it's not a novel that I have actually read from cover to cover, although I was certainly aware of it when I started writing Jamestown. I started writing Jamestown because I had a job. Thanks. I had a job teaching what are called professional development workshops to middle school teachers around the city, and there was a group of middle school social studies teachers in Queens who wanted to teach a unit on Jamestown, and they wanted to use creative writing exercises to teach social studies, and so they hired me, and I began reading John Smith, Captain John Smith's several accounts of his sojourn in Jamestown, and I got the idea to write a big old creative writing exercise myself about Jamestown, but at that point all I had was this vague notion that this is really strange and beautiful and horrifying, that is the John Smith account of Jamestown, and it's also one of the founding myths of American national identity, and so that's kind of all I had to go on. And as I got deeper into the research and began to think about writing it, we as a country got deeper and deeper into our wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and my own understanding of causality is not that these wars were caused by the terrorist attacks on the World Trade Center, but that the World Trade Center attack was a kind of pretext for the Bush administration to do what it had wanted to do anyway, which is run a pipeline from the Caspian Sea down to the Arabian Sea through Afghanistan, and then for various reasons, which are still somewhat elusive to me, depose Saddam Hussein and, I don't know, spread democracy, let's say, to the Middle East. So, you know, this somewhat apocalyptic thing happened in my backyard, more or less, about a mile and a half south of where we're sitting right now. And then I saw these fairly apocalyptic scenarios developing across the ocean, perpetrated by us. And there were some stark similarities between what the British were doing in the early 17th century in terms of colonial expansion and what I see us doing now in the early 21st century in terms of colonial expansion. And that's what I think ended up making the sort of odd concatenation of premises that happened in Jamestown.
Well, I was going to actually say that there are obviously Iraq parallels in this book, but I read the book more as this kind of, I guess, broad sort of, you know, expose of military blunders, not unlike what, you know, Lord Tennyson being inspired by Lord, you know, Cardigan's mischief in terms of the Great Light Brigade as well, you know. Was this specifically more intended as, I guess, a more holistic sort of reflection of military blunders and colonial expansion along these lines? Or was this more intended as a kind of more contemporary prism? And also sort of a side question, sorry to throw so many at you, the sort of response by some reviewers as this being sort of related to Iraq, do you think the kind of contemporary patois, the sort of, I guess, IM and chatty vernacular that reflected through wireless devices is probably one of the reasons why people tend to view the more recent parallels as opposed to the more historical sort of parallels?
Yeah, well, I guess both. That's frequently my answer to these kinds of questions. As one of my professors in graduate school, a great poet named William Matthews, said, it's always both, and it's always your mother. So I will leave the latter part of the quotation out of this for the moment. I wanted it to be very much about our history, about the history of Jamestown, and I there were many events in my novel that directly parallel events that happened in Jamestown. I also wanted it to be a reflection of contemporary American life, and I think starting the book with the Chrysler Building crumbling to the earth was meant to signal that. But I wasn't writing the novel to be strictly allegorical. I did not mean for people to read the novel and find one-to-one parallels between things that are happening in the novel and things that are happening in Iraq. I meant it to be sui generis. I meant it to be its own fictive world that made allusions to contemporary American foreign policy, 17th century British foreign policy. And I suppose as for all the different modes of discourse or forms of rhetoric or references to styles of communication or communications technologies like blogs, emails, IMs, prayers, memos, telepathy, sure, I think I am just immersed in American vernacular, and it's the medium that I use to express myself, and so I do want my novel to be a reflection of not a satirical take on Iraq in particular, but a reflection of who we are as a nation at this moment, and who we have been and who we might be, kind of all compressed into a single moment. So yeah, I think novels are kind of great omnivores. They're sort of great beasts that gobble up all the ways that people use speech and writing in any given era. And so I wanted my novel to reflect how Americans talk and think and write now. So I used all those kinds of modes of discourse.
You alluded in your other answer to the other question of basically sort of pouring through a lot of the letters. And I'm wondering, in terms of transposing some of the speech to, I guess, contemporary sort of patois or vernaculars, how much of this was a matter of transposition? How much of this was a matter of, I guess, recontextualization? I mean, did you actually, like, go to various MySpace pages to get the sort of Pocahontas banter, assuming, of course, that nobody kills me for mentioning the name? Well, actually, not the real name, actually.
Which real name?
Yeah, which real name, yes. Yeah, anyway. Was it a matter of, I guess, did the actual original sort of texts of Jamestown, you know, serve as a kind of starting point, or did more contemporary forms, like, you know, going through various other contemporary vernaculars, serve as a starting point? Maybe, what was the ratio between your invention and your, I guess, transposition, so to speak?
I had no strict ratio in mind, and it might be that somebody else would have a better sense of what the ratio is than I do. I don't think that either one was the starting point. I think, in a sense, again, they were both the starting point. I suppose, for me, when I start a novel, I can have the story in mind, I can have the characters in mind, but it isn't until I know how it's going to sound that I'm really able to start writing.
Yeah.
So I do various kinds of note-taking, and there's just long periods of really trying to figure out who's going to tell this and what is that person's voice going to be like. And in the case of Jamestown, it's many people telling it, and it's many different voices. And so it took quite a while to kind of get that mélange to where it felt right, or it felt like something that I wanted to proceed with. So I think it had to be more than one voice coalescing at once for me to begin to feel comfortable enough to write the novel. And then I think within any given character, there are multiple voices. So I think this is a long way of saying, I don't know.
That's perfectly okay. In terms of, like, you know, the first part of this book deals specifically with, like, Rolf and Pocahontas. Odd pronunciation. You know, I'm curious as to, you know, did you have to, I guess, master these particular two voices before you could then sort of, I guess, devote the book to having, in many cases, like, five or six people sort of interchanging over the course of a chapter?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I guess I had to figure out how Johnny Rolfe and Pocahontas were going to talk first.
Yeah.
But then all the other characters are entering the novel through dialogue, and there's lots of dialogue in all the chapters. So even as I was developing the voices of Rolfe and Pocahontas, I was also having to develop the voices of Powhatan, Sidney Feingold, Captain John Smith, John Ratcliffe, John Martin, all the people named John in the novel.
Buckaroo Banzai there?
What's Buckaroo Banzai?
All the Johns there, you know. I'm not sure if you've seen that movie, Bunkaroo Banzai.
Are there a lot of people named John in? I saw it a long time
ago.
Yeah,
all the aliens in that movie are named John something.
I was going to ask you about that. And then there's that Monty Python sketch where all the Australian guys are named Bruce. Hello, Bruce. Hi, Bruce. Yeah. I'm sorry, I've...
Oh, we were talking about, I guess, mastering the voices and all that.
Okay.
Well, okay, I mean, the thing is that's interesting about this is that you actually have dialogue embedded within perspective. And I'm curious in terms of... one can read it two ways. I mean, you know, depending upon how much one wants to trust these narrators as to, you know, what's actually happening. You don't have actually a lot of overlap, multiple sort of takes on a particular perspective. You have like little snippets here and there that kind of add up to actually go into, you know, a sort of all-encompassing narrative. And I'm wondering if this this particular attention to how one hears was something that you were working on as you were perfecting these voices, or was it a matter of just really kind of getting the voice down?
The two possibilities you're suggesting.
The two possibilities is one can read this two ways. As every time I read, say, a Rolf chapter, it's Rolf's perspective of what he's hearing.
Yeah.
Or I could read this as, okay, I'm hearing how Rolf is sort of describing the situation, but the dialogue itself is actually more or less objective. If anybody was there, they'd more or less, you know, actually hear it that particular way. Did you plan in the devising of these vernaculars?
Yeah, I'm not a big planner of these things, I have to say. I kind of wing it. It's kind of an improvisation. But I think I would say that I was aware in a section being narrated by any given person, that person's sensibility is going to inflect how they record and transcribe what other people are saying.
So I
am aware that in a Johnny Rolfe section, what Jack Smith is quoted as saying or what Pocahontas is quoted as saying is going to be filtered through what Johnny Rolfe is hearing.
Or perhaps not, because Rolf is the communications officer. Therefore, maybe he might be actually having more accuracy for the given situation.
Except he's not a very... He's kind of a sullen and introverted and not very... an ungregarious communications officer. So I kind of meant his being a communications officer would be somewhat of a joke.
Yeah. Well, there's the whole scene where he's... There's that very funny scene where he and the Indians are attempting to communicate to each other via wireless communication devices. And it's really... You really reveal him as just being the most reluctant possible communications officer that they could have actually employed there.
Yeah, right. Well, he's also, as he says at a certain point, not really down with the intention of the trip down south. So he's for whatever his skills are as a communicator, he doesn't really want to be a communicator for this particular endeavor that he's not in agreement with the particulars of. I would say he's like any of the rest of us. He's sometimes good at communicating and sometimes bad, and sometimes good at listening and other times bad. It was meant to be a bit of a joke that this sullen, sometimes extremely uncommunicative guy is the communications officer.
Well, it's also something of a really pretty funny conceit that the one thing that actually seems to be working in this future are wireless communication devices and instantaneous sort of chatter.
Yeah.
And this seemed to me this great kind of irony as to, you know, here are all these possibilities to communicate, and yet no one can actually sit there and actually meet face to face and actually resolve these matters. Brooklyn is at war with Manhattan, and the Indians are at war with the settlers. I mean, the list goes on and on. I mean, it seems to me that your concern here was very much with this notion of communication, and in particular, communications options being open, yet nobody's actually really using this in the right way. Even the letters going out are to whoever is out there, it's like almost like a blogger, as Ed Park wrote in his review in the book form, almost like a blogger writing into the ether, you know?
Yeah, right. I thought that was funny that he said any blogger who has a low hit count
knows
exactly. Yeah. Well, I mean, I suppose there's an autobiographical connection for me to that particular conceit, namely writing an email or a blog without being certain whether there's a recipient, which is when I started writing this, my last novel, The Sleeping Father, was still without a publisher.
Yeah.
Despite the kind of remarkable efforts of my agent, I had not yet found Soft Skull. Every major publisher, every mainstream publisher in America had rejected The Sleeping Father. So I kind of felt like I was also writing without being certain of having an audience. So that was my little private joke I was telling myself about that. But yeah, I mean, you know, the internet is based on this communication system designed by the military to be able to withstand a nuclear war, right? So with this communications network intact after some kind of major devastating battle. And to me, I didn't need to make up the irony of this. The irony was already present in the world. I needed merely to observe it. I think you put it very nicely. We have these elaborate communications systems without the actual communications content.
But it's not just a matter of that. It's also a matter of, like, why one chooses to communicate into the void. It's almost like no one is listening is the sense that I'm getting as I'm reading this book, and that's what makes it rather funny in my view, but also rather tragic as well, because these people, I guess, are all looking for this sort of emotional connection, and it very nicely weaves into this whole reframing of the Jamestown situation.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose I meant also as a larger metaphor for communication, or for the attempt of any single person to reach, to get through to, send a message to any other person. It's always somewhat dicey, you know. I think we're born alone, we die alone, and in some way, it's not really possible to translate exactly who we are into somebody else's mind. I guess the metaphors, I would hope that the metaphors work on a number of levels. There's this attempt at cross-cultural understanding and communication that happens in the novel that does have its parallel both in the English trying to communicate with the Indians and vice versa, and our attempts now to communicate with the Iraqis and vice versa. Then there's this love affair at the heart of the novel, where these two people from two different cultures, Johnny Rolfe and Pocahontas, are trying to communicate with each other across linguistic barriers. And I suppose that the communication between two lovers is a kind of metaphor for the cross-cultural encounter, and vice versa. The cross-cultural encounter is kind of a metaphor for communication between two lovers. Or, I mean, another way of thinking about it is, any communication between one individual and another individual is, in a sense, people from two different cultures trying to interact with each other. You know, the culture of Matt and the culture of Ed trying to come together with this thing that seems to be the same language, but oftentimes doesn't feel like the same language.
Well, the other thing, too, is, I mean, it's a matter of also mishearing things. There's, like, you have the characters literally, like, sort of have these phonetical sort of, you know, versions of phonetical manglings of names for, like, you know, Sydney Feingold instead of Sydney Feingold.
Oh, right.
You know, things like that. So, I mean, communication also is not, it's just a matter of, I guess, these characters in many cases, perhaps because of the rather terrible conditions, aren't able to really sort of latch on to the joys or the possibilities of those, you know, literal mishearings. And was this, I guess, another sort of these ways of exploring this communicative divide? Was this also another thing that, I guess, motivated some of the really kind of the I am conversations too, as well?
Yeah. I mean, I was playing around with that idea that what you hear is in some way inflected by what your expectations are. And so the English are expecting the what they presume to be the Indians to have, you know, what we think of as Indian names, like Dances with Wolves. And so when they hear Sydney Feingold, they can't really hear Sydney Feingold because they're expecting something that has some, an animal in it or somebody or a noun and a verb or something. So they hear instead Sydney Feingold. Mm-hmm. But yes, I get, you know, you mentioned the joys of mishearing or the joys of the puns that arise from mishearing. And I suppose for me, when I was writing this novel, I was keenly aware of how very, very grim it was. Far grimmer, I think, than any of the other fiction that I've written. Not only because of the almost unrelenting violence and bodily degradation, but also because of the sort of hopelessness of this world end scenario. And so for me, it was very important that there be this sense of joy. And so for me, the sense of joy may not happen at the level of representation, but more at the textual level, you might say at the semiotic level or the level of wordplay, where these misunderstandings, while not the least bit funny to the people who are engaged in them, might be funny to the people who are reading about them.
Or might even be helpful to you because you're writing about these grim circumstances and these little, you know, things are perhaps there to amuse yourself or to, and thus amuse the reader? Or?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think even now that I do seem to have an audience, I certainly don't take that audience for granted. And in some way, I always feel like I'm writing out into the void and I have no idea what the reaction of any given reader is going to be. And so I do have to keep myself entertained. And it's really my own standards that are ultimately the only ones that I can really adhere to when I'm trying to write this thing. And so, yes, I need to keep myself entertained. In some ways, I always think of a novel as this private little joke I am telling myself on a series of mornings over the course of 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years or however long it takes.
But when you're trying to keep yourself entertained as you're also trying to sustain multiple vernaculars, is there a sort of danger in getting lost in the tapestry? Or?
Yeah, there are many dangers. Sciatica is one of the dangers I encountered while writing this novel. But getting lost in the sauce is definitely one of the dangers. Not knowing where I am at any given moment in the novel, not knowing whose voice I'm supposed to be channeling. But then, you know, I guess I've learned to enjoy certain of the features of novel writing that are not that pleasant. You know, I've at least learned to recognize that anxiety, that sense of confusion, that sense of despair, that sense of maybe I will never reach the end of this as, I don't know, interesting challenges.
I'm wondering if you actually one day wrote, like, accidentally in another voice as you were writing a chapter or something like this.
Yeah, no doubt. Yeah, I mean, lots of accidents end up being, spontaneous creations.
Or but also happy accidents, too, sometimes.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I guess that's what I'm trying to say, is that I try to remain open to all the accidents that happen. Like my fingers are going too fast, faster than my brain, and so I misspell something, and then I go, oh, all right, maybe that's an, you know, things like that, yeah.
I actually wanted to ask you, where did the N-shaped tents come from? That didn't come specifically from Jamestown.
Well, the houses that the Indians lived in do resemble the lowercase N. I mean, I don't know why I ended up having Pocahontas spend so much time referring to the letter N. I guess the only explanation I can come up with, and I don't think it's an adequate one, is that I was calling attention to the linguistic nature of this world that I'm creating, that it is a world made out of language, and that it's the constituent parts of language are the letters.
It's the IPA, essentially.
The what?
Oh, the IPA there. The phonetic, international phonetic. I had a rather sort of bizarre observation, but I think I'll put it to you. I wanted to actually talk about the bus ride that opens up the first part of the actual book.
Yeah.
It seemed very much reminiscent of Kerouac, this kind of, I guess, on the road sort of experience, as well as Hunter S. Thompson. In fact, there was one thing that you have Johnny Rolfe write, a few miles out of Delaware, a log or ruck got lodged in our tank tread. And this reminded me very much of the opening to Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And I'm wondering if these kinds of, I guess, again, going back to this notion of recontextualizing other texts, if the American road novel was very much, or even the gonzo sort of journalism was very much in your mind when you were planning out this bus trip.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm a fan of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. And I love that trip that they take in the convertible, I believe, right? And then I guess I also had in mind, you mentioned Kerouac, but whom I also like, I think I had in mind, you know, with the bus, I had in mind Ken Kesey, the Merry Pranksters, Tom Wolfe's take on this, are you on the bus or are you off the bus?
Yeah.
So that was very much, I think...
Considerably more violent on this particular Merry Prankster experience.
Yeah, right. The American road novel was definitely part of the collage that I was trying to make.
I'm wondering if, because since you're dealing with so many different sorts of inputs here, or different sort of, I guess, exemplars that you're actually placing into the actual book, was there a specific sort of thing that you designed or method that you did to, I guess, kind of keep everything sort of cohesive? Or did you pretty much sort of accept it as a kind of melange, that basically the unifying details would be actually the vernaculars throughout the entire book?
I think the sort of framework for me was probably more at the level of plot. And, you know, I think I had to start the novel to begin to understand what the plot might be. But once I started it, I kind of came up with you know, the very simple and in some ways quite dopey, but profound narrative that I think you see worldwide in the history of literature, which is going away and coming back. Or as Freud would say, Fort Da. You know, there's that essay by Sigmund Freud where he's observing his, I think it's his grandson, and he's got one of those little toys at the end of a string, and he's in his stroller, and he keeps throwing away the toy at the end of the string, and then he keeps reeling it back, and when he throws it away, I think I'm getting this right, the word for away is fort, and the word for here is da. I could have them reversed. But in any case, Freud observes this, and he says, in some way, this is the fundamental human drama, going away and coming back, or something being not there and then being there. And then literary critics like Terry Eagleton have said, yeah, and that's, in a sense, the fundamental paradigm of narrative as well. Something's there, something's not there. Something's in place, something's out of place. So I think I just formulated that going away and coming back as kind of the fundamental structure for improvisation. And then I guess the sort of one level down, one level more micro than that, is the three-part structure of the book where, as you alluded to, Johnny Rolfe and Pocahontas are narrating the first section of the book. The second section I meant to have multiple narrators speaking in floating voices, that is, not moored to a particular technology of writing or speaking. Yeah. And then the third section is back to Pocahontas and Johnny Rolfe being the only two narrators. So then I think for me that was enough of a structure. And then the alternating, you know, one narrator, another narrator, another narrator, which, speaking of American novelists, I probably borrowed from Faulkner and specifically from As I Lay Dying.
Yeah.
And then, as you say, just the idea that each character would speak in a distinctive vernacular or blend of vernaculars, I think that was about as much structuring as I'm capable of. And then beyond that, just kind of what it felt like on any given day.
So is this essentially Matthew Sharp's melting pot here, or what?
yeah, a melting pot in which none of the constituent elements quite melt.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I think I've done this in all my books. They're always fairly explicit allusions to songs, poems, novels, stories, myths written by other people or handed down from one generation to another. But I think it became more explicit in this book because of the historical nature of the book and because of, I think, the overt theme of wanting to blend historical periods, wanting to blend different vocals and literary styles. So I think that in a way gave me permission to be quite overt about my stealing scenes from Richard III, scenes from King Lear, Otis Redding lyrics, Paul Robeson lyrics, Britney Spears lyrics, Wallace Stevens poems, Emily Dickinson poems, I Am Style Speak, MySpace, etc.
Sure.
If we are allowed to take that name in vain.
Yeah, you could take anything in vain as far as I'm concerned. But then there's the risk of actually packing so much information into what I would argue is sort of historically a comedy structure that goes back to Dryden or Aristophanes, to me anyway. The one review that I read that just really infuriated me was Susanna Meadows's, to my view, tone-deaf, and I'm sure you're empathetic because you're the author, but her tone-deaf review in terms of Jamestown, where she quibbled over the fact that, oh, well, all the jokes in this book are, some of them are ha-ha funny and some of them are not. Therefore, the book must be flawed in this sort of sense. But I read this book considerably differently in the sense that tonally, everything is striving for that particular sort of, I guess, historically comedy sort of note. And I'm wondering if you're having the New York Times Book Review, actually, you know, which some people consider to be the great sort of, I guess, literary organ that determines what literature is, if this cannot actually detect this historically comedic tone, then, you know, is there a sort of problem in terms of embedding too much into a book like this?
I must confess that I have not read that particular review. A number of friends have described it to me so that I have a sort of cubistic portrait of...
Probably a wise decision on your part.
With my first book, I did read all the reviews, including the negative ones, and certain phrases from those negative reviews are seared on my brain and will probably constitute the contents of my last thought before I die. So I've sort of made it a habit not to read the negative reviews. But look, she's just, I mean, the New York Times certainly is an important review organ for us novelists, but on the other hand, that particular reviewer is just an individual person, so I don't know that she represents the Times, the Times' you know, take on literature. She just represents her own abilities to and her own proclivities. So I understood when I was writing this book that it would exclude a lot of sensibilities. That, you know, I think Ed Park also mentioned that the Sleeping Father was more of a crowd-pleasing book than Jamestown. And I was pretty keenly aware of that. And as I said before, ultimately, since I can't guess in advance what any particular reader's response is going to be to what I write, I kind of have to go with my intuition and write to my own standards, and that's all I can do. So, yeah, I know that this weirdo book that I wrote is not going to appeal to everybody, and, you know, tough noogies.
Well, at the same time, you know, you have, I guess I would argue that it does matter, these literary organs, simply because there is a far more conservative literary climate than was the case like 20 or 30 years ago, when you had like these incredible, you know, essays championing postmodernism by John Barth or William Gasser, etc.
Yeah.
And so, to my mind, it seems like when you have James Wood coin the term hysterical realism to describe anything that doesn't fit into this neat, naturalistic sort of view of what literature should be. So it seems to me that it would matter, and it's actually sort of your efforts are running counter to these other efforts. So what do you do as a novelist? Or does the critical, you know, reaction actually matter? Or you know, perhaps there's perhaps misreadings of your books in order to prevent people from actually seeing that there is far more playful undercurrents, that there's this grand melange going on. So
yeah, I guess you're right. Sure, critical response does matter, and I suppose we're in a moment that's on the conservative side. On the other hand, you know, other reviewers in the Washington Post and in Salon and in the LA Times did seem to understand and appreciate the postmodern pastiche that I was trying to enact. And you know, and then there are people like that. There's that beautiful essay by Ben Marcus in Harper's where he talked about experiments in language. Yeah. And what those experiments do for readers who are willing to go along with them, and for the you know, the development of the language in general. And so I'm hopeful. Mm-hmm. And again, I like what I like. I write what I write. I would, of course, like, this is my livelihood, so I would, of course, like people to read it. And I do have an interest in people writing more adventurous and speculative fiction having a wide audience. But all I can do is write what I write and hope that people are interested.
Well, to respond to this notion of hysterical realism, the notion of Brooklyn and Manhattan at war against each other, it's both a sort of preposterous notion, but it's also, you know, I mean, now I have moved here and I've seen the Brooklyn versus Manhattan. I live in Brooklyn and I go to Manhattan and I see this. They're at loggerheads against each other. And it does not seem all that unreasonable if things were to escalate into a sort of apocalyptic scenario where Central Park was gutted of its trees and the like. So I suppose what is, I guess, the balance between, I guess, maybe it doesn't matter or maybe it does matter. But I mean, if something, I suppose, is real enough, when you take a thematic concept like that, you know, is it just a matter of actually making it believable, or is it a matter of actually drawing upon something that is just plausible to be believable when you're framing it within the context of fiction?
Yeah, I'm not sure that my book is either plausible or believable. I just hope that it coheres as an artistic vision. That, you know, I am, if I could be called an experimental novelist, and I'm not sure that I can, because I think in some ways I'm quite conventional. One of my concerns is to make an entertaining plot, and I suppose I mean entertaining in the sort of etymological sense of having, you know, enter comes from the Latin root that means between, and tain comes from the Latin root that means hold, and so I want to hold a reader between the world that the reader is in and the world that I'm creating in the fiction. And so one of the ways that I do this is by having a certain amount of forward momentum, and I think that allows me to not have to be real or plausible or believable or, you know, in any way I want a reader also to be, as we discussed with the N-shaped houses, I want them to be aware at all times that this is a linguistic confection and to take pleasure in that. Mm-hmm. So I suppose that does make my book not that conducive to the kind of book group in which people want to read the words as a sort of window or transparent surface through which to look at the lives of the characters, and then in a way also to have it reflect back on their own lives. I do want people to be able to compare the lives of the people in my book to their own lives, but I also want them to be aware that they're looking at art.
Well, with that fine notion, well, thank you very much, Matthew. It's a pleasure chatting with you.
Oh, yeah, thanks. Right,
thanks.
The old songs, we called them doe songs, and we'd harmonize the clear, even though it was the beer that made the tears run about the years gone by. And we'd go home and kiss the wife, hoping a kiss could change your life. That's how romance is, no second chances. Back in my